Chapter 35. Our family was no longer getting larger. There were no new spouses on the horizon, no new babies. My aunts and uncles, Sophie and Edward, Fergie and Andrew, had stopped growing their families. Pa too, of course. An era of stasis had set in. But now, in 2002, it dawned on me, dawned on all of us, that the family wasn't static after all. We were about to get smaller. Princess Margaret and Gangan were both unwell. I didn't know Princess Margaret, whom I called Aunt Margot. She was my great aunt, yes. We shared 12.5% of our DNA. We spent the bigger holidays together, and yet she was almost a total stranger. Like most Britons, I mainly knew of her. I was conversant with the general contours of her sad life. Great loves thwarted by the palace. Exuberant streaks of self-destruction splashed across the tabloids. One hasty marriage, which looked doomed at the outset and ended up being worse than expected. Her husband leaving poisonous notes around the house. Scalding lists of things wrong with her. 24 reasons why I hate you. Growing up, I felt nothing for her, except a bit of pity and a lot of jumpiness. She could kill a houseplant with one scowl. Mostly, whenever she was around, I kept my distance. On those rarer than rare occasions when our paths crossed, when she deigned to take notice of me, to speak to me, I'd wonder if she had any opinion of me. It seemed that she didn't. Or else, given her tone, her coldness, the opinion wasn't much. Then one Christmas, she cleared up the mystery. The whole family gathered to open gifts on Christmas Eve, as always, a German tradition that survived the anglicizing of the family surname from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor. We were at Sandringham in a big room with a long table covered with white cloth and white name cards. By custom, at the start of the night, each of us located our place, stood before our mound of presents. Then suddenly, everyone began opening at the same time. A free-for-all, with scores of family members talking at once and pulling at bows and tearing at wrapping paper. Standing before my pile, I chose to open the smallest present first. The tag said, "From Aunt Margot." I looked over, called out, "Thank you, Aunt Margot. I do hope you like it, Harry." I tore off the paper. It was a biro? I said, "Oh, a biro. Wow." She said, "Yes, a biro." I said, "Thank you so much." "But it wasn't just any biro," she pointed out. "It had a tiny rubber fish wrapped around it." I said, "Oh, a fish biro. Okay." I told myself, that is cold-blooded. Now and then, as I grew older, it struck me that Aunt Margot and I should have been friends. We had so much in common. Two spares. Her relationship with Granny wasn't an exact analogue of mine with Willie, but pretty close. The simmering rivalry, the intense competition, driven largely by the older sibling, it all looked familiar. Aunt Margot also wasn't that dissimilar from Mummy. Both rebels, both labelled as sirens. Pablo Picasso was among the many men obsessed with Margot. So my first thought, when I learned in early 2002 that she'd been taken ill, was to wish there'd be more time to get to know her. But we were well past that. She was unable to care for herself. After badly burning her feet in a bath, she was confined to a wheelchair and said to be swiftly declining. When she died, February 9th, 2002, my first thought was that this would be a heavy blow to Gangan, who was also in decline. Granny tried to talk Gangan out of attending the funeral, but Gangan dragged herself out of her sickbed and shortly after that day took a bad fall. It was Pa who told me she'd been confined to her bed at Royal Lodge, the sprawling country house in which she'd lived part-time for the last 50 years, when she wasn't at her main residence, Clarence House. Royal Lodge was 3 miles south of Windsor Castle, still in Windsor Great Park, still part of the Crown Estate, but like the castle, it had one foot in another world. Dizzyingly high ceilings, pebbled driveway winding serenely through vivid gardens, built not long after the death of Cromwell. I felt comforted to hear that Gangan was there, a place I knew she loved. She was in her own bed, Pa said, and not suffering. Granny was often with her. Days later, at Eton, while studying, I took the call. I wish I could remember whose voice was at the other end. A courtier, I believe. I recall that it was just before Easter, the weather bright and warm, lights slanting through my window, filled with vivid colours. "Your Royal Highness, the Queen Mother has died," Cuts to Willie and me, days later. Dark suits, downcast faces, eyes filled with deja vu. We walk slowly behind the gun carriage, bagpipes playing, hundreds of them. The sound threw me back in time. I began shaking. Once again, we made that hideous trek to Westminster Abbey. Then we stepped into a car, joined the cortege, from the centre of town along Whitehall, out to the Mall, onto St. George's Chapel. Throughout that morning, my eye kept going to the top of Gangan's coffin, where they'd set the crown. Its 3,000 diamonds and jewelled cross winked in the spring sunlight. At the centre of the cross was a diamond the size of a cricket ball. Not just a diamond, actually. The great diamond of the world, a 105-carat monster called the Koh-i-Noor. Largest diamond ever seen by human eyes, acquired by the British Empire at its zenith. Stolen, some thought. I'd heard it was mesmerizing, and I'd heard it was cursed. Men fought for it, died for it, and thus the curse was said to be masculine. Only women were permitted to wear it.